number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on anonradio.net.
Okay. All right. Today is Tuesday, the 9th of July in the glorious future year of 2024. And I think the workmen who are working on the front door have mostly finished with the very loud drilling and hammering and sawing and general banging and slamming and that kind of thing. Meaning that we can actually have a show, live show, without a great deal of distracting background noise. Aside from the squeaks and so on created by my librarian's step stool. People who think that oil as a source of energy is going to vanish overnight because of the success of battery electric cars. You know, I hate to tell you, but the proportion of battery electric cars now being sold is modest, and the average lifespan of a car these days is well over 10 years. So aside from the fact that private cars account for about two-thirds, a little bit less than two-thirds, of the energy, of the oil consumed in transport, which in turn is about half of all oil consumption. But been working on graphs for number two of BLAST, and I had a what I think is a clever information presentation, but the problem is to explain to people how it works. There is no such thing as a self-evident, self-explaining graph. Let's see, what else? Now, I guess we can now get back to Slide Rule, the Autobiography of an Engineer. When we left our narrator, he was talking about the first flights of the airship R-100. I got back to the ship at about 9 o'clock. I got back to the ship that night at about 9 o'clock. It was a cloudless, moonlit night and freezing hard. The ship lay at the mast 100 feet above the ground, brilliant silver in the beams of the floodlights. There was a crew on board her, in accordance with the routine procedure at the mast. I found them at supper in their mess, content and settling into their new quarters. There was no heating in the ship when the dynamo engines were stopped, and it was very cold. In the control car I found Booth, dead tired, wearing a Sidcot suit and huddled in a small armchair beside the shore telephone, nursing the ship's black kitten as he kept his watch in the brilliance of the floodlights. I went on aft to the power cars and worked till midnight with the engineers. We flew again next day with the intention of doing speed trials. The speed of R-100 at that time was a sore point at Cardington. With all politeness, the officials there professed themselves unable to believe our ship to be at least 10 miles an hour faster than their own. R-100 was, in fact, the fastest airship that had ever flown at that time, or to this day, for all I know, her full speed was 81 miles an hour. We did not reach full speed upon that flight, however. Prowling through the ship in search of trouble, somewhere over Kettering, I heard a little flapping noise of fabric in the region of the lower rudder, and discovered that a sealing strip across the rudder hinge was coming unstuck. This was not serious, but we did not care to take the ship up to full speed till it had received attention in the shed. We cruised around for a few hours and landed to the mast again in the middle of the afternoon. I believe the USS Macon and the Hindenburg were a trifle faster, but only, you know, by a couple of knots. The landing on this occasion was a demonstration of the special qualities of the airship. A thin, frosty mist hung over everything. From 700 or 800 feet, it was just possible to distinguish the ground immediately below. In these days, every modern aid would be required on such an afternoon to guide an aeroplane onto the runway. In those days, flying would have been most hazardous. In the airship, everything was peaceful and secure. We had radio telephone communication with the mast, and coming up to the aerodrome, we slowed to a mere crawl, running on one engine at about 10 miles an hour, with two other engines ticking over slow astern, ready to check her way if anything loomed up ahead of us. In the control car, there was time for a little conference between the officers over each movement of the controls, as, putting her nose down a bit, isn't she? Think so. We could afford to be 50 feet lower. Starting to show on the fore and aft level, sir. About 2 degrees nose down. All right, coxswain, 5 degrees elevator up. And so on. During all the flights that R-100 made, I do not think that it was ever necessary to make a quick decision in the way that the pilot of an aeroplane has to. There was always time to talk the matter over if it seemed desirable and decide what action should be taken next. It is impossible to describe what a sense of security this freedom from quick decisions gave to one who was accustomed to flying aeroplanes. Rightly or wrongly, I felt as safe through all the flights that R-100 made as on a large ship. We put the ship into the shed that evening, put her back in the box, as somebody irreverently described the operation. Here she stayed over Christmas, while we sorted out her teething troubles, berthed in her shed beside R-101. Some of us had seen R-101 before she flew. We now had a good opportunity to examine her in her completed state. We found her an amazing piece of work. The finish and the workmanship struck us as extraordinarily good, far better than that of our own ship. The design seemed to us almost unbelievably complicated. She seemed to be a ship in which imagination had run riot, regardless of the virtue of simplicity and utterly regardless of expense. Mind me. The servo motors were there, large as life and every bit as heavy. The gas valves were of a novel design and reported to be very sensitive. Being located on the side of the bags, a small degree of rolling would cause them to open and lose gas. Airships, however, don't roll very much. The feature of the design that perturbed me most of all was the method of taking the thrust of the engine in the power cars to the hull. The engine in each car drove a pusher propeller. A large thrust bearing was mounted in the boss of this propeller, from which a heavy steel cable ran straight aft to a point on the hull 50 feet back. It was fairly common practice in the airship world to take the thrust through a propeller in that way, and in fact it gave no trouble, but it seemed to me most dangerous and quite unnecessary. A competent engineer should be able to do better than that. He doesn't tell us what method he used in the R-100. It was then a few days before Christmas. I had been working at a high pressure for some time and enjoying it. Now was the first part of the flight trials. Now the first part of the flight trials had been completed, and we had nothing much to worry about. I arranged the program of work that was to be done on the ship, rang up Bernie to get leave, rang up someone to inquire a good place to go to in Switzerland, and was skiing at Murren before Christmas. I think in many ways that was the best holiday I have ever had in my life, because I came to it with a sense of achievement, of a difficult job well done. Moreover, for the first time in my life I had plenty of money at my disposal. I don't think it lasted longer than a fortnight, because I had to go back to my job, and wanted to, but that fortnight was a good one. Back at Howden, the big ship seemed very empty without the Back at Howden, the big shed seemed very empty without the ship. Practically all the men in the shops had been laid off, of course, but Bernie had fixed up a design contract for a future airship from the Air Ministry, with which to keep the experienced design staff in being till the flight trials were completed and the future program for airships could be decided by Parliament. By that time, in January 1930, the Depression in the United States was in full swing and its impact was becoming felt in England. It was becoming clear that two competing airship design staffs would not be kept in being through the hard times that were in sight. If more ships were ordered, either Cardington would build them or we would. The decision which staff would be chosen to carry on largely depended on the performance of the two airships. The designers of the less successful ship would very soon find themselves looking for another job. This was an important factor in the later flight trials of the two ships and in the ultimate tragedy. Urged by the instinct for survival, both parties forced the flight trials ahead quicker than they should have gone, intent on proving that their own ship was the better. It was my good fortune that we had the better ship. I've seen people in later years try to, mostly very recently, try to cast doubt on the R-100, saying, you know, it's just a myth that, you know, the R, it was a product of Cold War propaganda. You know, the R-100 is a capitalist ship and is good, the R-101 is a communist ship and it was bad, or this, that, and the other thing. And what I have to tell you is, from everything I've looked at about the R-100 and the R-101, I think the criticism given a page or so back by our author here is very right. The R-100 was the better ship not because of capitalism versus socialism or anything else. The R-100 was the better ship because it was less complicated, making it easier to build, making it so the people who built it knew it better, and ultimately easier to maintain. The work on R-100 was finished about January 10th, 1930. She was then ready for further flight trials, and we stayed waiting for a calm to bring her out of the shed. Not much notice can be given of a dead calm, and so it was not particularly discourteous that I received a telephone call from Cardington at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on January 17th to tell me that the ship would be brought out at dawn next day and would fly immediately. Cardington is about 150 miles from Howden, and that day was my birthday. I had arranged a small party of friends from the Flying Club at a hotel in Leeds. Remarking that there was time, Master Drake, to finish our game of bowls, I arranged with the calculator who was coming down with me for the flight that he should meet me in Leeds at 11 o'clock, and we would drive down to Cardington through the night. It's a reference there to the great sea battle between the British forces under Francis Drake, or English forces, really, under Francis Drake, and the Spanish Armada. One does these things when one is young. I had reckoned without a freezing fog all down the Great North Road. I had a pretty little Singer coupe at that time, an advanced car for its day, but like others at that date, it had no fog lights and no heating. Even parking lights reflected from the fog and made driving impossible, but with no lights at all, we could see the sides of the road and could keep up about 20 miles an hour. Very soon the windscreen iced up, but it was designed to open, and we drove along like that. Ice formed on everything. It was nearly an inch thick on the inside of the roof above our heads. It coated our overcoats and formed in a great mass on the steering wheel between my hands. It was a tough drive. We got out every hour or so and stamped about to get the circulation back, and once or twice we found a coffee stall in Stamford or in Grantham. By 5 o'clock in the morning we were within 30 miles of Cardington, and we could still use no lights, and now we began to meet cyclists on the road, farmhands perhaps, going to milk the cows. We very nearly hit one a couple of times, and each time suffered a hair-raising skid upon the icy road as I braked heavily. I gave up then and parked by the roadside. Better to miss the ship than to stand trial for manslaughter. An hour later the dawn came, and we could see a little better, and got going again. We drove into the air station at 8 o'clock, and to my delight, the ship was only just leaving the shed. The same fog had prevented the RAF handling party from getting to the aerodrome at the appointed time. We scrambled on board and had breakfast as the ship rose up into the air. All that day we flew above the fog and clouds in bright sunshine. We suspended a variety of airspeed indicators on cables below the ship and worked her up to her full speed, which, as I have said, was 81 miles an hour. We had several of the Cardington officials on board during this flight who took this result with long faces. We all tried to get them to disclose what the full speed of R101 was, but they turned stuffy and wouldn't tell us. The subject was evidently an awkward one, and we had to abandon it. The value of a full-power trial lies in the effect it has in disclosing weaknesses in the outer cover of the ship. In the case of R100, the outer cover took up a curious wave-like formation when the ship was at full speed, which was not evident at cruising speed. These harmonic deflections ran longitudinally down the ship from bow to stern. They did not move at all. I climbed all over the ship with the riggers between the gas bags and the outer cover while the ship was at full speed to examine the attachments of the cover to its wiring system, but I could find no place where the attachments were unduly stressed. Finally, we came to the conclusion that the matter was of no importance and was probably due to large-scale eddies of the air that passed over the hull. And indeed, there are some photographs of R100 at full speed in which you can see exactly this. The outer cover was a weakness in both R100 and R101. In each ship, the policy had been adopted of building with relatively few longitudinal girders compared with previous ships, in order that the forces in the girders might be calculated more accurately, and this decision was undoubtedly influenced by the disaster of R38. A ship with few longitudinals, however, must of necessity have larger unsupported panels of outer cover fabric than a ship with many. In both ships, the outer cover was the main weakness. Extended flight trials were to prove that our outer cover on R100 was just good enough for the service demanded of it, but only just. In those days, you had to use linen treated with airplane dope. These days, you'd use ripstop nylon, and half of the problems they encountered would just go away. The rigid airship would be far easier now. But yes, Zeppelin-type airships normally have intermediate longitudinal girders, which are not part of the supporting framework as such. They don't carry the main structural loads. All they do is support the outer cover fabric. R-100 made another flight about January 22nd to investigate the curious deformations of the outer cover at full speed. We flew to Farnborough, where an aircraft from the experimental station came up and flew alongside us to photograph the cover while I was crawling about inside the hull with the riggers. At cruising speed, about 70 miles an hour, the cover was quite normal. The officials at Cardington grumbled a bit about it, inferring that we were selling them a bad airship, but they had no leg to stand on technically, and it was decided to let the matter go. So far as I remember, Bernie clinched the matter by pointing out that our contract only called for a top speed of 70 miles an hour. If they wished, we would put a stop on the throttles of the engines to prevent the ship from going faster than that, which would make the cover quite all right. The contract for R-100 called for a final acceptance trial of 48 hours duration and a demonstration flight to India. This latter flight was changed to a demonstration flight to Canada when the decision was taken to equip R-100 with petrol engines, because it was thought that a flight to the tropics with petrol on board would be too dangerous, would be too hazardous. It is curious, after over 20 years, to recall how afraid everyone was of petrol in those days, because since then, aeroplanes with petrol engines have done innumerable hours of flying in the tropics, and they don't burst into flames on every flight. I think the truth is that everyone was diesel-minded in those days. It seemed as if the diesel engine for aeroplanes was only just around the corner, with the promise of great fuel economy. It was decided amicably, therefore, that R-101 would make the flight to India, since she had diesel engines, and we would fly to Canada instead. I may mention here that the aerodiesel was beginning to be a reality in the late 1930s, that both the Germans and the Soviets had diesel-powered airplanes circa 1940, but not very many of them. And then, of course, the war intervened, and in the U.S., and to a certain extent in Britain, every new technology that could be developed was being developed, but in Germany and the Soviet Union, not so much. The Soviets had to build a lot of stuff quickly, which meant that they had to build stuff that they already knew how to build, and the Germans were building one or two of every conceivable idea and not mass-producing anything, really. And then, of course, the turbine engine came along, and for the longest time there was no development in aviation reciprocating engines at all. But nowadays, the aerodiesel is coming back for a very simple reason, which is the final end of leaded aviation gasoline. A diesel engine can burn jet fuel. So yeah, diesel engines burning jet A are beginning to come in for smaller airplanes. The final acceptance trial of R-100 lasted for 54 hours. It was an easy and effortless performance, bearing out the old saying of the RNAS that the only way to get a rest in the airship business is to take the thing into the air and fly it. That would be Royal Naval Airship Service. We left Cardington on the morning of January the 27th with 22 tons of fuel on board to burn before coming down, and we landed again on the afternoon of the 29th, having lived very comfortably in the meantime. The weather from the start was vile. At Cardington it was misty, with a moderate wind and signs of rain. We came down to 700 feet over Oxford, but saw nothing of the ground. We never flew lower than about 700 feet in R-100, and seldom so low as that. Our normal flying height was between 1,500 and 2,000 feet. We passed on to Bristol in very bad weather, cruising at 55 miles an hour on three engines. 700 feet being only the length of the ship itself. By the middle of the afternoon, we were on the south coast of Cornwall, in a wind of over 50 miles an hour. We put on a fourth engine, to bring the speed up to 65, being unwilling to increase speed more until we saw how the ship behaved in the rough weather. She answered her controls well, but in this wind she took a long, slow pitching motion of about 5 degrees each way. This very slow pitching was the only motion that she ever took in bad weather, except once in the vicinity of Quebec, when she rolled a little in a patch of violently disturbed air. Nobody could ever have been sick in that ship. By dusk we were at the Channel Islands, and heading up channel to spend the night out over the North Sea. The ship had quite comfortable little two-berth cabins for 50 passengers, and we who had no routine duties went to bed at a normal time. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I woke up, and becoming aware of my responsibilities, I went down to the control car. I found them changing watch. On inquiring where we were, I was told that we were passing over Lowestoft. I asked what we had come there for, and I was told that since the wife of Steph, third officer, came from Lowestoft, we had come as a graceful compliment to empty our sewage tank over the town. Steph was killed in R-101. I do not think that he would mind if I recall our ribaldry that night. The ship was then thrown into a turmoil because somebody had drunk the captain's cocoa. I'm not sure it wasn't me. Seeing that she was in good hands and not falling to bits, I went back to bed. I was up again at dawn to find us crossing the coast at Cromer on our way to London in increasing fog. As we got near the city, the normal white fog changed to thick, black, greasy stuff that left great streaks of oily soot upon the outer cover. It wreathed apart once and disclosed the Tower Bridge immediately below us. Then it closed down thick and black. We saw nothing more till that evening after tea, when we picked up the lights of a fishing fleet in Torbay. I don't think anybody appreciates how horrid the urban smokes used to be before electrification and gas. And the Clean Air Acts and so on. No, sir, anybody who talks about heating with wood has got to remember that wood produces just as much smoke as coal produces. And, of course, the guys are at it again in the entryway. I hope it's not too obnoxious. At about 8 o'clock, in the darkness, we went out to the Eddystone, and using the lighthouse as a center, we did comprehensive turning trials on port and starboard helm for nearly an hour, calculating the radius of the turns by timing ourselves on a complete circuit and getting the circumference of the circle from the airspeed. I have often wondered what the lighthouse keepers thought to see the lights of an apparently demented airship going round and round their lonely rock in the dark night. All night we cruised the channel. We went up as far as Portland and out into the Atlantic to the Scillies. At dawn, when I came down to the control car, we were cruising over Cornwall. In the rising sun, the valleys were all filled with mist, as if it had been poured out of a bottle, and this mist was white and gold and pink in the clear light, very beautiful. That morning, we went up the Bristol Channel at an easy speed. Near Bristol, we ran into cloud and rain again. We landed to the mast at Cardington in the middle of the afternoon, with the ship very wet, but none the worse for her long flight. I think it was during this flight that I went outside on top of the ship for the first time. R-100 had a little cockpit on top at the extreme bow, forward of the first gas bag, and reached by a ladder in the bow compartment. This was for taking navigational sights with a sextant. From this cockpit, a walking way ran aft on top of the ship along one of the girders. This was a plywood plank, a foot in width, with the outer cover stretched over it. To give courage to the inexperienced, it had a rope lashed down along it every 2 feet or so to serve as a handhold. This walking way ran the whole length of the ship to the rear of the fins, where another hatch was provided behind the last gas bag.
The slope of the hull at the bow cockpit was about 45 degrees, which made the first part a little tricky to climb, and personally, I always went from bow to stern, because the rush of air pushed you up the first climb, and you didn't have to look down. When the ship was cruising at about 60 miles an hour, as soon as you got to the top or horizontal part of the hull, you were in calm air, crawling on your hands and knees. If you knelt up, you felt a breeze on your head and shoulders. If you stood up, the wind was strong. It was pleasant up there, sitting by the fins on a fine sunny day, and whenever I went up there, I would usually find two or three men sitting by the fins and gossiping. We kept a watch up there in daylight hours to keep an eye on the outer cover, and the riggers got so used to it that they would walk upright along this little catwalk with their hands in their pockets, leaning against the wind and stepping over my recumbent body as I crawled on hands and knees. Bernie lost his wristwatch up there one evening. It lay on top of the ship all night and was found by one of the riggers at dawn next day and returned to him. This was one of the features of an airship, which distinguished it from the aeroplane. You could climb all over every part of it in flight and carry out repairs or maintenance that might be necessary. If the wind hampered the work, then you reduced speed. We did not care to run R-100 slower than about 20 miles an hour because some elevator control was necessary to keep the ship at a given height without continually valving gas or jettisoning ballast. But that speed was sufficiently low to permit the most extensive repairs, as we were to find out later. After this flight, the ship was put back into her shed for a considerable time. We formally handed her over to the Air Ministry, which means that we gave her to our competitors at Cardington, her English trials being satisfactorily concluded. They proceeded to make a number of modifications to her in preparation for the Atlantic flight. She did not fly again till sometime in May, when we made a flight of 24 hours duration in her, cruising over Lancashire and Yorkshire. In this flight, the light tail fairing... Pardon me. In this flight, the light tail fairing of the hull, the last 10 feet, well aft of the gas bags and the fins, suffered damage due to a high aerodynamic pressure. Wind tunnel tests on the model had shown suction forces over most of the hull aft of frame 3 at all angles of inclination, but at the extreme tail of the model a pressure test had been shown. By the time this was appreciated, the tests were over, the model had been dismantled, and the wind tunnel was working upon other matters. We discussed this one isolated point of high pressure with the aerodynamic specialists. Nobody, with the knowledge we possessed at the time, could explain theoretically why there should be pressure there, so we assumed it was a false reading due to some experimental error. But it wasn't, and this empty little framework of light girders collapsed. The Cardington designers, who were now in charge of R-100, solved the problem by cutting off the offending pointed tail and modifying her stern to a bluff rounded shape not unlike the cruiser stern of a ship. This had the advantage of shortening the ship by 15 feet without much detrimental effect, but it cannot be said that it improved her looks. This modification kept R-100 in her shed for a month or so, and in the meantime R-101 came out to the mooring mast for further trials. It had been realized before Christmas that the small disposable load of R-101 would make a flight to India impossible because she couldn't carry enough fuel, and a program had been put in hand to try to put her right. All unnecessary equipment, including the useless servo motors, was taken out of her. Her gas bag wiring was let out to increase her gas volume, and, last resort of desperate engineers, she was to be parted in the middle and an extra parallel portion inserted in her length, containing an extra gas bag. These alterations finally brought her disposable load up to 49.3 tons, still five tons less than that of R-100. In fairness, however, it must be realized that her diesel engines used less fuel than ours, so that, in the end, there might not have been much to choose between the ships in regard to range and load-carrying capacity. Unfortunately, from what anyone can tell,
loosening the wiring of the gas bags had the nasty property of making the ship surge in a fore and aft direction, pitching up and down uncontrollably by the nose, which is probably what destroyed the ship in the end. And congratulations to Unimagine Incom, who at this company has not had a useless, boring meeting. The meetings are on substantive issues and things get done. It was impossible to insert the extra bay in R101 at once. Of course, because it had to be fabricated first. And when she came out to the mast, the thing being right, to insert an extra bay, what you do is you take the point of maximum diameter and you part the ship there. So you need to construct a second transverse ring of the same dimensions and detach the longitudinal girders from the first one and attach them to the new ring, and then you insert another section of longitudinal girders in between them. Anyway, if you've done your stressing and aerodynamics right, this should not be an important modification, because the point of maximum diameter should be the point where the ship is least stressed. It was impossible to insert the extra bay in R101 at once, and when she came out to the mast for further trials in June, the ship had been gutted of all superfluous equipment and the gas bags had been let out. Immediately she was put onto the mast, in a very light wind, the outer cover split longitudinally, making a tear 140 feet long. The wind was rising, so she could not be put back in the shed, and the riggers mended it at the mast. A second, shorter split occurred the next day and was mended. They reinforced the cover with tapes stuck on inside with dope and made a short test flight. They then made two more flights in daylight on consecutive days, each lasting for about 12 hours. These were less for technical reasons than to show the ship at the rehearsal for the RAF display at Hendon and at the display itself. Publicity was important to them. They did no full power trial, probably because they were afraid of the outer cover. During these two flights, R101 grew steadily heavier due to loss of gas. From the addition of the water ballast dropped and the fuel consumed, she seemed to be losing lift at the rate of nearly a ton an hour. At the time, it was thought by the captain of the ship that it was due to the oversensitive gas valves chattering on their seatings, but more probably it was due to the chafing of the gas bags against the girders of the ship, since the wiring had been let out to increase the volume, which had resulted in many holes. Some correspondence revealed that the accident inquiry took place in the Air Ministry about these gas leaks. The inspector of the Aircraft Inspection Department, whose duty was to ensure the airworthiness of the ship so far as her construction was concerned, put in a written report upon these leaks, finishing up, "Until this matter is seriously taken in hand and remedied, I cannot recommend to you the extension of the present permit to fly or the issue of any further permit or certificate." Nobody at the Air Ministry knew much about airships, and this criticism was forwarded to Cardington for comment. The designers of the ship were thus being asked to adjudicate upon the soundness of their own work, being asked to decide if their ship was safe or not. Their credit, in comparison with ourselves, was at stake now. The palisade was hard around them, forcing them along a road that they would never have taken if they had been free men. To put it in another way, if R101 had had gas leaks of that magnitude, they would have declared her unairworthy at once, and rightly so. They replied, in effect, that gas bags in airships always had touched the girders, and that a little padding of the girders was an effective cure. They probably indicated unofficially that they thought the inspector was an old woman making a mountain out of a molehill. The tone of the official correspondence supports that view. So R101 was put back into her shed, she was parted in the middle and the new bay was inserted, she was fitted with two new engines capable of reversing by an adjustment to the camshaft, the many points where the gas bags were bearing heavily against the girders were padded, and most of her outer cover was renewed. Apparently, however, they didn't proceed to take the wiring back in, which I think is what they should have done once the new bay was in place.
It was stipulated in the contract for R-100 that the ship must demonstrate her ability to carry out intercontinental flights by a flight to Canada. I do not think that this requirement was exactly a contractual liability, because, to the best of my recollection, our expenditure upon the ship ceased when she was handed over to the Air Ministry at the conclusion of the English trials, but the requirement had been written into the contract 6 years before, in 1924, and up till June 1930 it had never been questioned. R-100 was to go to Canada, and R-101 to India, as soon as the English trials were over. The Cardington engineers, after the June trials of R-101, began to put forward tentative and unofficial proposals for a postponement of these long flights to the following year. They said that the two airships were in an early stage of development and that neither ship was fit to make a long flight at that stage. A disaster might set back the whole cause of airships in England, and it would be a pity to run any risk for the sake of getting on quickly. Development would go on better if we did not hurry it. They suggested, through unofficial intermediaries, that both staffs should take that line and jointly ask for a postponement of these long flights. Perhaps if we had realized at the time how very, very bad their ship was, how real the danger of complete disaster if they started for India, we might have taken a different attitude to this approach. Their own secrecies concealed the real facts from us. We guessed that their ship was a bad airship, but we did not know the whole story. We brushed aside this approach, perhaps roughly. We said that our ship was perfectly capable of flying to Canada. The Canadian flight was a part of our contract, and it was necessary for it to do it. And it was necessary for us to do it. Again, the bitter competition between the staffs loomed large. A heavy loss had been made upon the construction of R-100. If this was to be recouped from future airship contracts, ours must be the organization to carry on the work, and they must give up. We would complete our contract and prove the efficiency of R-100 by flying to Canada. They could please themselves whether they flew to India or not. With that, perhaps, we drove the final stake into the palisade around them, blocking their one way out. It must have been about this time that a very distinguished scientist visited Cardington to see R-101. He was, of course, completely ignorant of airships, and R-101 was a very big and very well finished, altogether a magnificent-looking piece of engineering. He was shown over the ship by her chief designer, who later was to lose his life in her, and at the conclusion of the visit, the scientist was full of praise for what he considered to be a wonderful achievement. He said that the designer must be a very proud man. The chief designer answered, "I suppose it ought to be a great satisfaction, but somehow I feel too tired." Actually, let me go get a little drinking fluid, and I'll be back just in a moment. It's hard to know now, of course, but I suspect that properly modified, the R-101 could have been a very satisfactory airship. But yeah, it's hard to know. The information available at this point is inadequate to make any judgment, I think. Chapter 5. From that time on, the atmosphere at Cardington became very bad, certainly so far as we were concerned. Arrangements were being made for a flight of R-100 to Canada with very bad grace. For some technical reason, I had to go to Cardington about the middle of July. I flew down in a Club Moth, piloting myself, and landed it just outside the airship hangars. This method of traveling in summer weather saved several hours of driving time and much fatigue. but it might have been better if I had gone down by car, because any suggestion that we knew more about the air than they did probably rasped sore nerves, and none of them could fly an aeroplane. I tell you what, you shouldn't have people working on an aviation project or aeronautics project who don't know the air. My technical business involved a conference with the chief members of their organization, all but one of whom were later to lose their lives. They were quite polite, but nobody invited me to lunch in their mess room, although our business was to extend into the afternoon, and I would have gone without lunch altogether if the captain of R-100, distressed by this incivility, had not taken me to his home. When our conference was over, the officers and crew of R-100 came to help me start my little aeroplane and see me safely off the premises, but nobody else came. Perhaps they were all watching from their office windows, hoping I would crash. Towards the end of July, R-100 was brought out to the mast again, and we made another flight in her of 24 hours duration. Technically, this flight was completely uneventful. One incident perhaps deserves a record. In the dark night, out somewhere over the Atlantic near the Scilly Isles, we asked for our position by wireless. Perhaps the two direction-finding stations were nearly in line with us, making a bad cut. Perhaps they were merely sleepy. They replied, with a creditable promptitude, that our position was 2 miles southwest of Guildford. Major Scott made a signal in reply. Many thanks for position. See very rough at Guildford. Politeness invariably pays. This was the seventh flight that R-100 made, and the last before she crossed the Atlantic. There were no troubles to be rectified, and little to be done before we started off, except to put more fuel on board. We returned from this flight on Saturday. On the following Tuesday morning, we set off for Montreal. Looking back upon those days, I have sometimes wondered if we were very rash in taking the Atlantic flight so early in the ship's career. On the whole, I do not think we were. R-100 had made only 7 flights before we started for Canada, but in those flights she had flown over 150 hours and had covered 7,000 or 8,000 miles. She had repeatedly been flown at full speed, and she had flown for long periods in very bad weather. We had no reason to anticipate any trouble with the engines, as these were of a well-proved aeroplane type. At the same time, there is no doubt that our Atlantic crossing was dictated by political motives alone, as in the case of the Indian flight of R-101. It is doubtful if any responsible technician would assert that a large and totally experimental aircraft is fit to cross the Atlantic on its 8th flight. The most that he could say would be, as I said, that he knew of nothing that would prevent it doing so in safety. This guarded approval of the project was all that could fairly be given at that stage. In that respect, our position was precisely similar to that of the designers of the R-101, except that we had more flight experience behind us and a better ship. Considered purely from the technical aspect, it was not very prudent for either airship to attempt a long flight at that stage of development. We did, and got away with it. Whenever I make a lengthy or an interesting journey, I usually keep a diary, and my diary tells me that I spent the Sunday on the ship with the crew, making a very comprehensive inspection. One of our many petrol tanks was leaking a little, and we changed it for a new one. I went to London about midday on Monday, buying an overall and rubber shoes on the way, and reported to Bernie that we were ready to start. That evening at my club in Pall Mall, telephone calls confirmed the start for 3:30 a.m. the next morning. So I stood myself a very good and expensive dinner, followed by a glass of brandy and a cigar, read a novel by A.P. Herbert for a couple of hours to my great content, went to Bernie's house with my linen kit bag, and drove with him to Cardington in the middle of the night. On this flight, Sir Dennis Burney and I represented the constructors, and a Lieutenant Commander Prentice represented the Admiralty. 3 members of the Cardington party traveled with us, and a representative of the Aircraft Inspection Department. The diary, written during the flight, may tell most of the story from now onwards. For July 29, 1930. We slipped at 3:50 a.m. summertime. We have 34.5 tons of petrol on board, which should be ample. At the last moment, the ship was light, and we delayed some time in filling up two emergency water bags, half ton, forward. We slipped with practically full emergency ballast, dropping one bag aft to get the tail up. It was just light enough to see the fields. The preparations were better done than I have ever seen them. Nobody but the officers and the coxswains in the control car, and everything smart and efficient in the dim light. We slipped, and a great cheer from the tower told us that we were clear. Booth rang on all engines and put her nose up, and we forced her up to about 1,000 feet in the half-darkness. Our course will take us over Liverpool. There is a small depression northwest of Ireland. By passing north of this, we should get a favoring wind this afternoon. We hope to make good time. We had a very expert meteorologist on board, who later was to lose his life in R101, and every 6 hours we took a radio signal consisting of a great number of code groups sent out specially by the Air Ministry for us. From this we made up a fresh isobaric weather plot. An airship is so slow that one never butts into a headwind if it can possibly be avoided, and we altered course repeatedly to go the right way round the depressions and find a favoring wind. That morning we went northwest till we were off the west coast of Scotland and north of Ireland. We then turned westwards and found a beam wind, as forecast. I slept till about 8 a.m. and then breakfasted. Petrol was pumped manually to the gravity tanks above the power cars in R100, and we all assisted the crew in this monotonous chore. For the rest, I roamed the ship as usual, looking for trouble. Of course, he says, an airship is so slow. His favorite little airplane, the de Havilland Moth, had a top speed lower than R100. p.m. A good lunch, soup, stewed beef, peas, potatoes, greengages and custard, beer, cheese, coffee. We are butting along in low cloud at about 1,300 feet on four engines at 50 knots. The wind is northerly and strong. We are off the northwest corner of Ireland, making good about 40 knots on 270 degrees magnetic. Everyone a little comatose after lunch, and the crew are playing their gramophone. Can't help loving that man of mine. Probably we shall head a little south soon, and get south of a high-pressure area down there, and so find a favoring wind. Sea about force 5 and very desolate. It beats us all how anyone could have the courage to attempt the Atlantic in an aeroplane. In R100, the passenger coach was within the hull, about one-third of the ship's length from the bow. Large windows in the outer cover permitted quite a good view from the passengers' promenade decks. The control car was immediately beneath the passenger coach, outside the contour of the hull. All three power cars were aft of that, the nearest being about 120 feet aft. The passenger coach and the control car were therefore practically noiseless, and the gramophone was heard as clearly as in a house on land. The walls dividing the cabins were of fabric, so that a man snoring in the next cabin could be a real nuisance at night, so quiet was the ship. Wednesday, July 30th, 8:40 a.m., zone time, GMT minus 2. Position is about 54 degrees 20 minutes north and 35 degrees west. We altered course a little in the night to steer rather more northwards, heading for Belle Isle at the north of Newfoundland and the entrance to the St. Lawrence. This because the meteorological chart made up at about 1 a.m. disclosed a shallow depression east of Newfoundland. By going round the top of this, we shall get a following wind, and this we have now actually got and have had for a couple of hours. We are cruising at 50 knots on four engines, but are making good 74 knots over the ground on practically a due westerly course. This is fine, and we hope to pick up Belle Isle about 900 miles from here this evening. We are running in thick fog. Gas bag 7 appears to be leaking, as it was when we started, and has risen a good bit. The others are holding well. I slept splendidly in pajamas, sheets, sleeping bag, and blanket from 11 p.m. to 7:30 a.m., There has been no motion of the ship whatever on this flight. Pumped petrol before turning in, and again before breakfast this morning. The comfort of this flight is almost staggering. Sleep all night in bed, get up, shave in hot water, dress and eat a normal breakfast served in a Christian way. If this water collector can be developed, as I think it can, we may be able to have baths in future ships. Not sure if he's referring to the apparatus for condensing water from the exhaust, or for rain gutters on the ship, for collecting water that fell as rain. Although the Zeppelin company had a third method, which was to lower down to the surface of the water and suck it up with a hose. "11 a.m., zone time, GMT minus 3. We had a sweepstake on the day's run, noon to noon GMT. Eldridge won it with 1,095 sea miles. We are doing much better now. Everything in the ship is satisfactory. In the fins this morning, I came on Deverell, reporting a little chafed hole in the cover about the size of a penny. The crew are continually on the lookout for incipient damage of this sort, and take it before it has had time to get very far. They did a little sewing and doping on the top of the top elastic hinge strip of the port elevator yesterday, in anticipation of damage that had not yet happened. A good, keen crew." Of course, they mean the old-style British penny. Nah, twice the diameter of the new penny. "We have just about the size, in fact, of the new 2P piece. We have just stopped the aft engine in the aft car and put on one of the wing car engines to replace it, still running on four engines. A flexible water pipe to the radiator is chafing on the car structure, and something has to be done about it. This is the first time we have had to stop an engine for adjustment or repair. The job will take about an hour. 4:30 p.m. zone time, GMT minus 4. The fair wind has gone, and we have a 20-knot wind against us, very near dead ahead. This is in accordance with our prediction from the depression centered about Hudson Bay. We have put on power and are now running on six engines, the forward ones at 1,500 rpm and the aft ones at 1,600 rpm. This gives us about 58 knots, 66 miles per hour, and we are making good about 42 knots over the ground. Belle Isle is just about 100 sea miles ahead. It has turned cold and gray. Visibility is moderate between frequent rain showers. At this speed, pumping petrol is serious work. In a larger ship, it will be necessary to put in mechanical pumps. Thursday, July 31st, 2:30 a.m. zone time. We are well inside Newfoundland, running up the St. Lawrence River, have had asked to be called to help pump petrol. We are still running on six engines at 58 knots, but have a headwind and are only making good about 36 knots over the ground. Johnston is asleep in a chair in the saloon, in teddy and uniform cap. He is a splendid navigator and works like a horse. I believe he had only 2 hours sleep last night. A teddy was a combination flying suit used only in airships. It was made of teddy bear fleece inside and out. Airships were normally unheated and were difficult to heat technically, though we had an elementary electrical heating system in R-100. I had a teddy issued to me for the flight. I never had occasion to wear it, but it was a very warm and comforting garment for those who had to stand motionless on watch. Squadron Leader E.L. Johnson was probably the most experienced navigator in the Royal Air Force at that time. He was killed in R-101. Well, you've been listening to Hear Now the Words on AnonRadio.net, a service of the SDF Public Access System, Unix System. This Hear Now the Words program is every Tuesday and Friday at 15 hours UTC. Don't forget my other program, A Step Farther Out, commentary on the state of the world, technology, and the future of mankind, but mostly not computers, at 1900 UTC Saturdays, just before the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. If you'd like to support these broadcasts and don't want to mail me wads of cash, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, patreon.com/Publius_reads. And coming up next is